Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Take Five with Dave Brubeck, the great American jazz pianist and composer who died on this day in 2012. And we are going to look today around the globe and see some of the things that are affecting this country, affecting the continent of Africa, affecting the Middle East, affecting us all with our guests. And we are joined once again by Dr. Fahim Yunus, who is a senior fellow at the Hofburger Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore and a clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Maryland. Dr. Max Hilaire is with us, chair of the political science department at Morgan State University. And Sam Faddis is a noted author, retired CIA operations officer, author of many books. The most recently is his novel, Kaffa, which we have yet to do in the air, but we will do soon because I really did enjoy it. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have all three of you with us.
Thank you.
So I want to talk about a broad thing first, and with the three of you, before we get into more specifics of different things we're seeing. But you see al-Shabaab in the battles going on with al-Shabaab in Kenya and right there, especially in the areas that border Kenya and Somalia, where most of the violence is taking place. Boko Haram, which is gaining more territory in many ways in Nigeria and adjoining countries, and the presence of ISIS that is in Syria and Iraq and the world there. So I when you think about this and look at this situation, I'm curious from the three of you a sense of like an overall strategy and sense of how a world can deal with this. You know, I think Iraq and Syria can't deal with it alone. Don't some people they should and understand the argument, or Kenya or Nigeria. So where do we go in our discussion with the public about what should be the response to all of this? And how – well, let me start there. Max?
Thank you, Mac. I think what we are seeing is a transformation of the international system in which we need a new paradigm in addressing some of these issues. And we need new institutions and new forms of global governance to address these issues. Some states are very guarded about their sovereignty. Some are not willing to accept that the world has changed and we have competing non-state actors that are powerful in bringing about at least destruction or instability in the international system. And hence, governments have not begun to cooperate as much as they ought to in addressing these. These are not Iraqi problems or Syrian problems or Nigerian problems. These are problems that are global. But more importantly, I think if we look at all of these groups, whether we like it or not, these groups have concerns that need to be on the international agenda, and they need to be resolved diplomatically. There's no military solution to the ISIS problem or the Boko Haram problem or the al-Shabaab problem. In fact, this situation in Somalia has been going on for almost 30 years. So I think it's about time that we take a different approach instead of simply looking at it from a military or terrorism angle and begin to address this, bring some of the key people, if we can identify them, at the negotiating table and say, what do you want? But governments are not willing to recognize some of these groups as having legitimacy and hence think we could bring them down or eliminate them through military means, and it's not happening.
Sam, what's your take, especially on the diplomatic front? What is the reality of that for you?
Well, I think it's undeniably true that this is not exclusively a United States problem, and it's certainly not just a military and intelligence problem. And so we ought to be kind of mobilizing anybody and everybody and everything we can think of to work these issues. You know, my focus, as usual, is from our standpoint on sort of the pragmatic, what are we as a country going to do about these immediate issues? And I guess the way I would define that would be by saying we can't keep doing what we've been attempting to do, which is either ignoring the problems or deciding to pour hundreds of thousands of people and billions of dollars into this. We have to find, you know, a more pragmatic, sustainable way to respond to these things, because you just listed a whole bunch of disasters. And the reality is that anybody who's looking at the geopolitical situation will tell you that, you know, 5-10 years from now, all of those may still be going on, but there will probably be a whole bunch more. I mean, this, we're going to see this dynamic continue as far out as anybody can see into the future.
Fahim.
You started the question with a program with a loaded question here, Mark. Absolutely. What can we do? I'm from that part of the world originally, and I strongly believe these groups always existed. They're not new, like Max said. It's not the love of Islam that is now uniting them. It is their hatred of the United States, unfortunately. Because all of them look back at their history, and they all have, in one shape, form, have been bombed by us. There is huge resentment. And we need to start thinking about the policies of justice and fairness rather than the policies of national interests, which look very good in the short term. But in the reality, and what do I mean by one very crisp example, what do I mean by justice and fairness? Every U.S. president has tried it. Perhaps it's time to try once again for a just and lasting peace in Israel and Palestine. Just to give you one example, not to say that that is the epicenter of everything, but resentment comes when people see us taking sides, when people see us not standing by the side of justice. And as long as our foreign policy is simply dictated by generals, you know, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You need to bring in people who are diplomats. You need to bring in people who can look at that larger perspective and look at the consequences. Much of this that we are seeing today is a consequence of something. ISIS didn't erupt out of thin air. It's a consequence of something. And somebody has to just pull back, take our egos out of it, and really think through it as to, you know, that same old popular question, what would you do? You know, what would we do if somebody had, if we had that kind of a past? How easy it is for us to sit on a table with someone if we had lost 500,000 of our people. We've done that before. That's the kind of leadership that is needed.
So but let me get a little pushback on these ideas for a moment. I'm thinking about conversations we've had over the years here on the Mark Steiner Show around these issues. And some of the, like one quote from one of our Iraqi scholars who came on, comes on the show all the time, somebody who opposed Saddam and was forced to flee Iraq and also opposed the invasion of Iraq as misguided. Now says, though, and his argument with Phyllis Bennis on this program in a debate was that, no, you cannot negotiate with ISIS. There is no negotiation. There is no negotiation Boko Haram. There is no negotiation with al-Shabaab because while they may have been created, he said in ISIS's case, may have been created because of the war in Iraq and what exploded because of the war in Iraq and the oppression of Sunnis and more that happened. These are fundamentalists in Islam. They could be fundamentalist Jews. They could be Christians. In this case, they're fundamentalist Islamic force that has nothing to go. They don't want to negotiate. They have a vision of where the world needs to be, and it's a violent tradition from their perspective. And that you can't negotiate. Now, let's argue with it for a minute. Let's discuss with it. Is it possible that we are dealing with forces where at this moment in history there is no possible negotiation?
I agree with that. Very quickly, I agree with that. There are some forces, but ultimately, again, it's the fight for those 80-90% of the swing vote in those countries to deal with those forces. It's not our job. We cannot go in and try to neutralize Iraq from ISIS. We have to work and negotiate with the 80 or 90% of the swing vote, which is Shia and Sunni and Kurd in Iraq, and try to gain their confidence. That's my worry. We are losing that swing vote by the second. More and more of them are going to join ISIS because they don't see us taking a very clear position. Or whatever clear position we take, it does not resonate with that 90% of the swing vote, and that's where I think we should focus.
Well, I have to say, guns don't talk, people talk. So you could shoot your way to victory, but you're not solving the problem. And ultimately, even the leaders of ISIS or Boko Haram or al-Shabaab realize they could not defeat the United States militarily or the West militarily. So this is not a winning battle. It's not. You're not going to win on the battlefield against the United States and its more superior military power. Nor is the United States going to prevail fighting against an invisible enemy who could blend into civilian life, civilian society after killing the numbers of people and make it impossible to win. So you have to be able to identify moderate forces or people within these organizations who realize that there's no military victory and bring them to the table. Because ultimately, when you fight a war, the war doesn't end the problem. It's diplomacy that ends it. So somebody has to come to the two people, have to come to the negotiating table at some point and say, well, this is my position, this is yours, where do we find common grounds?
Now, when you look at history, Samuel, the conflicts always do, at some point in human, in every human conflict, and we always have these human conflicts on the planet, they come to an end for whatever reason. They could take 5 years, but it could take 50 years, it could take 100 years. There are things called the 100-year wars that took place in Europe. Things didn't just end overnight. But what about this question of how you proceed? I mean, and how the United States should proceed, how the West should proceed, how we deal with our the places we've become involved, like the Iraqi government, and where we are with that. I mean, this so in terms of what I was saying earlier, of what Dr. Talbot Abdullah was saying, the Iraqi scholar I was talking about earlier, said there is no negotiating.
Right. Well, I mean, ultimately, I think what you know, we can talk generalities, but when we're talking about each one of these specific conflicts,
right,
we need to get past the generalities and start talking about particulars. If you're talking about ISIS in Iraq, I mean, you have a certain number of individuals who probably you're ultimately going to have to either kill or in some other way vanquish, but they are obviously tapping into, in Western Iraq, issues that resonate with a much broader group of Sunnis that have to do with the divisions in that country between Sunni Arabs and Shia Arabs and so forth. And you know, you have to confront those issues. So, I mean, I think this is sort of feeding into what everybody's been saying. Part of that is a military answer to ISIS, but the bigger issue is if you want that Sunni population to side with you in this conflict, you have to address their issues and their grievances. Right now, as long as we are in effect asking them to fight against ISIS so that they can have the privilege of going back under what they regard as pretty close to an Iranian puppet regime in Baghdad, you're probably not going to have a lot of people sign up for that fight. They're not really interested in that. On the other hand, if you can promise them in some way or the other that things will be different, I suspect you're going to find a lot of people who will help you against ISIS in Iraq. Mm-hmm.
So it is that question to push when Sam just said, you know, what is talking about the military answer to ISIS? What would that be? Do you take out a few people? If you could say the same about Boko Haram in Nigeria, because Nigeria has the largest military force on the continent of Africa, and they can't rescue these girls, they can't stop Boko Haram, even though these new vigilante groups are popping up all across the areas that Boko Haram has taken to fight back. Villages are fighting back in a guerrilla war. But Max, that's why this is such a – I guess I'm trying to get to a point where we can talk about what kind of solutions there might even be to addressing groups like this.
Well, with Boko Haram, I think that situation is a bit more complicated than –
What do you mean?
Well, number one, Nigeria is a very complex place. Politically, it's a very divided country on geographic lines, on ethnic lines, on religious lines. And mind you, this is not a religious conflict in northern Nigeria because Muslims are killing Muslims and the Muslims are looking to the Christian-based government to rescue them. But I think what is going on in Nigeria is that there's been an unspoken agreement, an unwritten agreement that power would swing, the pendulum of power would swing between North and South. And the North who have dominated Nigerian politics since independence through military rule found themselves disadvantaged once civilian democratic rule was restored in Nigeria. And there's a reason for it. The vast majority of educated Nigerians come from the South, whether it's the Yoruba region or the Igbo region, and to some extent, the Middle Belt. And the most of the people in the military are Northerners. Now, there's some people from the West and from the East, but the vast majority of those who make up the armed
forces...
In the North is Islamic territory. It's Islams,
right.
Muslims. And what is happening in Nigeria is that they are not willing, because on a number of occasions, the soldiers have dropped their weapons, changed their clothes into civilian clothes, and fled. So they're not willing to fight Boko Haram. And I think there's elements within the top brass of the Nigerian military, Nigerian intelligence, and even in the Nigerian government that is seeking to undermine the authority of the president and hence want this conflict to go on to make it difficult for the president to gain re-election. Because he's a southerner, he's a minority, and he's a Christian. All factors that do not work well for the current political climate in Nigeria.
So, and we can look at also al-Shabaab and what's going on there. But what we're saying here, I think this is really interesting, but because even though, because in the minds of many Americans, you can take a conflict like we're seeing with ISIS and al-Shabaab in Kenya and Boko Haram and say, oh, it's all one thing. Because it started with al-Qaeda in the mountains of Afghanistan that hit the World Trade Center, and these things were all connected. But it is not one vast conspiracy. But there is a discontent among the poor masses of people, even though most of the people doing the fighting, at least in ISIS, are coming from many middle-class families and not necessarily poor families. But that notwithstanding, that there is could be a widespread disconnect, but these are not – they're connected in a larger social sense, but they're not necessarily connected in a political and military sense. Do you get that? Would you agree with that, Sam, or disagree with that?
Well, I think there are connections in the sense that you have an ideology that is spreading. But basically, the way I would characterize it is that ideology finds fertile ground where you have these pre-existing conditions. And so, you know, in Nigeria, yeah, if you're going to confront Boko Haram, there are going to be a certain number of those guys that are never going to put down their weapons. They're going to have to be confronted militarily. But the real secret to it is to address those underlying issues. You have this huge division between the Christian South and the Muslim North. You have issues of where all the money is going from the oil sales. You have real issues that are providing conditions that allow these guys to grow and operate and gather strength. And that's the long-term solution, is attacking those things that are allowing them to grow.
And same thing. I completely agree. It's a far more gray and nuanced situation in every country. These situations erupt out of political instability, out of hunger, out of lack of education, poverty. But the risk is, as you allow them to fester, there is this common thread of a very extreme version of the faith that they will see as a uniting factor. At some stage, they're going to get that big that they're going to have to form an alliance. And they have the idea that now, you know what, all of a sudden, I've really dominated Nigeria. It's time for me to spill over. It's time for me to make a larger partnership. How do I do that? That is where the faith element comes in, and that is where I believe the risk is for them to coalesce from Pakistan to Nigeria, because if you ever listen to one of those inflammatory sermons, when they twist my faith and try to convince the world that how Quran says this, that is extremely powerful, the way they do it. And yes, then they all become one united front.
Because if you take that and add to it, some other volatility into the mix from the region, which is in Egypt, which after the Arab Spring, people, naively or not, had real hope that a democracy was going to flourish, that you elected somebody from the Muslim Brotherhood to be president, Morsi of Egypt, was overthrown by the military. And whatever people think politically of Morsi or not, he was seemed to be trying to walk this path to keep Egypt together, even though he was making sure that his forces would dominate. He was trying to play some kind of a balance game here, overthrown. But that can only lead to, it seems to me, more discontent among young Muslim youth in Cairo and around Egypt, who become increasingly disenfranchised, and that has to be added to the volatility of this mix as well. We're not even thinking about the moment.
Well, and there's a real problem to that, Mac, because in as much as we saw the young people in Egypt demonstrating to remove one dictatorship only to have another dictatorship replace an elected leader. And maybe some people may not have liked Morsi's style. Clearly, Morsi was on a learning curve because he's been out of political power for so many years. There was never any chance to groom a leadership in Egypt. So he did make some mistakes. But the fact that he was elected and then removed by the military. But I think the broader issue is the response of the Western world, particularly the United States. We did not condemn. In fact, we struggled to call it a coup. And, you know, had all kinds of other names for it than to say it was a coup that would have led the United States to cut off funding to Egypt. So the people in Egypt and in the broader Muslim world are looking at these issues and saying, well, wait a minute, is the United States or is the EU interested in us who were the advocates of more transparency, accountability, the rule of law, democracy, and human rights, or they're basically interested in their self-interest? And clearly the United States has demonstrated, and the EU, that they're more interested in stability in the broader region. And if a strong man, Sisi, is the one who can do it, then we go with him instead of the masses who were protesting and looking for a situation or a system like in the West, which is what a lot of people are fighting for. They would prefer having accountability, the rule of law, and that everyone has an opportunity instead of having a system of patronage in their countries and perpetuating this unfairness and inequality.
So I want to, Sam, in your sense, and I read a lot of things you put up on the web and kind of your look at American and world politics, and I'm wondering if from your perspective, start here, that in the world of realpolitik, in the world of what governments have to do to address the issues that they have to face in their own national interest, are there alternatives from your perspective, starting with your analysis, of what could have been done, let's say, in terms of Egypt? In the role that America could play, and as opposed to the one that they did, or they have to play from your perspective, that the reality of Sisi, and you just have to go with him.
Well, so I mean, I would answer that question by rolling the tape back, you know, back to when we have the original uprising, if we can call it that, against Mubarak. I mean, a big caveat here, obviously, is we're sort of stuck with the cards we're dealt. And we don't always have all the options that we want. We would love to support somebody other than a strong man. It is unfortunately also true that in many of these countries, what happens when the strong man goes is there is not a viable alternative. In other words, we're looking for this pragmatic, largely secular, liberal, democratic middle that does not necessarily always exist in these countries. You're sort of sometimes stuck between two extremes with no ideal solution. I think the first problem we had in regard to Egypt over the last few years, and whether we could have successfully navigated this in a better way or not, I don't know. But the first problem is to just sort of be blindsided and apparently not have any long-term vision of where we're going. So we swing from we're just, I guess, going to support a strongman rule in Egypt forever to a blind faith that what's going to come out of the street is going to take us in the direction of some sort of true liberal secular democracy, rather than maybe attempting to influence events in a way that would have taken us a little more slowly and progressively towards some better result. We have now, as everybody's pointed out, effectively ended up right back where we were at the beginning of this entire thing. I mean, we've changed the guy whose name is at the top, but nothing else has changed in Egypt one whit. The exact same structure is in control of that country as it was before Mubarak was toppled.
Exactly, and one more layer to this, which is very difficult for us to swallow today. But those are the hard conversation that someday somebody needs to have. That we have to believe in our marrow that the world does not have to operate according to our definitions and our preferences. no matter how dear they may be to us. For me, the human right definition of America is so dear that I choose to make it my country every morning. There's a plane leaving to Pakistan every morning. Every day that I stay here, I choose to be an American. I'm very proud to be an American because I love those values. But people in the world may have a different value system for how they want to run their country, whether there's monarchy or democracy. They may have a very different view of LGBT rights. They may have a very different view of equality between men and women. And that is okay. I think that is where the part is.
What do you mean that is okay?
Because, see, there are fundamental religious issues and cultural issues. In Afghanistan, the way a woman dresses, it's very difficult for us to go out and expect that we will drop a bomb. This is the irony of this war, where we are using a $2 billion aircraft, dropping a $20 million bomb on a $20 tent, expecting democracy to come. If we want, you know, their definition of men and women equality could be very different. And we need to understand, are those women happy? And I'm not talking about stoning and whatnot. You know, there is a vision that there's recent, and then people say it's not racist. To me, it's quite racist when in downtown New York, you have this large poster of Homeland with this red blonde hair woman who's just lost in a sea of Muslim women who are dressed in a black garb. That's offensive to me. I'm okay, you know, because again, free speech, I'm okay. That's the, you know, they have a right to do that, but does not make it right. All I'm saying is that we create these subtle stereotypes of better and worse, of superior and inferior, and they're very derogatory. And then we lose that 90% swing vote. Those are little things, but people get a negative signal from us.
So we have to take a very short break here, and we're going to come right back. And I want to wrestle with what you just said and kind of push back a little bit.
Yes.
and have some conversation about this. So we're here looking at the United States and international affairs with Dr. Fahim Yunus, who you just heard, senior fellow at the Hofburger Center for Ethics, Dr. Max Hilaire, chair of political science at Morgan State University, Sam Faddis, author, retired CIA operations officer, and we'll be right back. Don't go away. On our way to break, we're hearing Revelation March by James Blood Ulmer, the free funk blues and guitar singer who recorded this album, Tales of Captain Black, on this day in 1978.
Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart?
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's the great Shirley Horn, My Funny Valentine, from her album I Remember Miles, who she loved very much, which she began recording on this day in 1997. We are joined here by Sam Faddis, who is an author and retired CIA operations officer, and we'll be linking to his website and all of his books. His latest novel is Kaffa. Dr. Max Hilaire is chair of the Political Science Department at Morgan State University, and Dr. Fahim Yunus is senior fellow at the Hofburger Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore and a clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Maryland. And so just coming back to where we left off for a moment, just a tad of a pushback. I was thinking again, at the very beginnings of the war in Afghanistan, after the attack on the World Trade Center and other locations here in the United States in 2001, and then the war that was that pushed onto Iraq from the United States. So it gave me a chance to have some interesting conversations with people from Kabul and people from Baghdad and other countries then after that, but in Damascus and in Cairo. And these were people who you would say are the more secular and some practicing Muslims, but not as deeply embedded in the fundamentals of religion as we're seeing today. And one of the things that women in Afghanistan were saying to me was, yes, you know, look, when the war started with Russia, the government there, though we may not have liked it, women were free. The majority of college graduates in Baghdad and the majority of college graduates in Kabul were women. They were the doctors. They were the engineers. They were the artists. Women wore miniskirts. They wore makeup in public. They weren't kind of threatened by this. There was a different world in the hinterland, a different world in the countryside than we had in our urban areas. So to me, in some ways, before I go back to Sam, Max, it was a very complex world. There was an urbanized world in the Arab and Muslim world that is much more is as cosmopolitan as any other nation on the planet Earth.
And, well, not only Afghanistan, but to go back to what Fahim said, I tend to take a different view in looking at this whole human rights and the differences in culture and traditions of the different parts of the world. I think wherever you go in the world, and I've been to quite a bit of the world, that the aspirations of every human being is to improve their living conditions. And I don't think the woman who is subjugated, whether it's in Africa, Latin America, or Asia, wants to remain in subjugation. In fact, most of these women work very hard. They are the breadwinners of their families. But they are deprived in certain ways because of culture, because of tradition, because of the domination of men of their societies. And hence comes the international community with some standards that is not what is, but what ought to be. And had we not have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, the Convention Against Torture and the Convention Against the Genocide Convention and the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights and Economic and Cultural Rights, the world would have been a very different place. Much of the problems in the world has to do with improving the human conditions of people. People want a change in their conditions, whether it has to do with a change in the economic system that exists in the world or the political relationship between North and South or East and West. But we need a different configuration where everyone can participate as equals. And we need to appreciate the diversity of the world, whether it's in religion, in language, in culture, in geography. But we have to understand we live in one world, we occupy the same planet, and sovereignty was just one way of addressing a unique problem in the world. It is not the solution to all the world's problems. And that's part of the problems we are seeing today. We have a mindset that is locked in 1648, where the world has left 1648 behind a long time ago.
Sam, would you pick up on this thread?
Yeah, look, coming from my usual optic here, here's the distinction I would draw, which is we can have whatever attitudes we have toward cultural issues, whether we're talking about gay rights or rights of females or whatever, and we can believe in those and we can advocate those and we can champion those as a country. That doesn't necessarily mean we should be attempting to translate those, particularly at the point of a bayonet, into something that we are imposing on other people. There's nothing that stops us from being in Afghanistan and in the normal work of the Department of State and so forth, advocating for gender equality and whatever else we are. And we should be. I'm not being facetious. We absolutely should be doing those things. That's a fundamentally different thing from thinking that you're going to go into somebody's country and order them and force them to change these things.
And
I would just say for the record that from a lot of years bumping around the world, I think the fastest way to start a fight with anybody is to start interfering in how they interact with the females in their population.
Absolutely.
That doesn't go over real big in any neighborhood that I've ever been in.
That's so true. That's exactly what I meant to say, that it's... Go ahead.
I hope you said it beautifully.
That's exactly my point, that you can't force people to change on gunpoint. And when we try to do that, we open ourselves to a huge amount of criticism that where is our human right violation and our flag of human rights in India, where there is more than 10 million women, girls being victims of gendercide? Where is our human right violation banner when we go to Iraq and deal with people? You know, when we're in bed with Saudi Arabia only because we're interested in their oil, and forget about everything else. Look at Ferguson, Eric Garner. Look at our own backyard. There are issues that we don't face, and then we take a gun and we go to somebody and say, you got to change because we think you have been practicing your life wrong for the past 500 years. We open ourselves to huge criticism. That's exactly what I mean.
Well, I can hear now my listeners. This is one of those rare programs when we have all men in the studio and not women. And I can hear my listeners going right now, where's the women's voice in this panel to say, wait a minute, they're women? I mean, and that women's rights. I mean, women's rights have become, I think, Max. And let's go around the room about this for a second. And we are all men today, so I apologize to my women listeners that we did not have a mixed gender panel, which we should have. But the women's people pushing for the rights of women has become our powerful movements in every country on the planet. And again, I'll go back to Afghanistan for a minute. When I first started covering Afghanistan here, right after the war, and we were the first program in the world to talk to Hamid Karzai from a cave in Afghanistan, so we've been covering it from the beginning, that we interviewed the women from Rawa, who were these women who worked in the camps of women and then snuck back into Afghanistan to fight for the rights of women. There are powerful women's groups in every society, no matter what the men say the women should do. I mean, so that's a huge force in this planet that we often ignore, I think.
Well, and we can no longer ignore it because, as you're saying, in so many of these countries, women are beginning to stand up for their rights. And women have always been in the forefront of the struggle, whether it's in Africa, the colonial struggles, or it's in the Middle East or Asia or elsewhere. And similarly, women have been in the struggle against communism and in Western Europe as well. We have made some progress in the West, but even in the United States, there's still problems, whether it's equal pay for women, whether it's acknowledging that a woman can be president of the United States.
Or Pakistan. In many other countries we could name.
Yes, right. You know. So we do have our problems with women as well, the fact that we simply cannot accept that these women are equal to men on every level, whether it's in the military or it's in public life. But I think if you look at the World Bank's policies, you look at the UN approach to development and anti-poverty policies, they're beginning to realize that the fundamental problem is addressing the needs of women and girls, because these are the ones who are left behind, but they are the ones who carry the brunt and the burden of the family, of society, of the economy. And I think it's just about time that we begin to acknowledge that women should have a say at the negotiating table on every international issue. And I think had it not been for women at the table after the genocide in Rwanda, after the war in Bosnia, we would not have criminalized rape, systematic rape, as a war crime or as a crime against humanity. So absolutely, the voices of women are necessary because they are the most oppressed. They are the ones who are victimized by many of these conflicts because they tend to stay behind with the children.
And I've written about it. Of course, that's absolutely true. The victimization of any human being is absolutely wrong. But once again, to paint, I think this is if I were a woman, I'd be deeply offended by that because you've rigged the game against me. Now, you've pretty much set male rules for me to prove myself, that unless I go out and make an equal wage, unless I become a president, I'm not good enough. I think the problem with this perception is that we have deeply underappreciated the institution of motherhood, the institution of a homemaker, the institution of people like our mothers, many of us. I think there is a reason we are sitting here. There's a reason I'm sitting here talking today, because it's because of my mother. And a lot of those world areas in Pakistan or in many of the Muslim societies, I can tell you, the institution of motherhood is extremely strong. And this vision, this perception that we create that a homemaker is somehow oppressed is completely flawed.
But I think that, again, if there are women in this room, they might challenge you on that, Fahim, saying very directly that the oppression of women on this planet and other countries, not just throughout the planet, had to do with being forced to stay home because we created this patriarchal world in our Abrahamic traditions that changed the nature of men and women, and that part of the problem is, I mean, look at right now. I look at what's going on. The articles I've been reading about taking the fight up against ISIS. There have been articles that was on PBS. It was in the Guardian, Global Voices Online, The Independent, all these journals talking about the role women are playing in the fight against ISIS. Some of the leading fighters and commanders now among the Kurdish forces are women who are picking up the gun, fighting ISIS, not staying home to mind their children, not staying home to teach, saying we are part of the battle to fight this fundamentalist force that wants to wipe us out. So I think that, I mean, the role of women in all these struggles are changing very deeply. In terms of political question, how should that influence, how should that influence our policies, our direction in dealing with these things we're saying we're facing in the world? How should that affect that?
Well, I think we ought to be absolutely crystal clear where we are on this issue, that we are completely for gender equality. I mean, I don't think this is really an issue of whether women should be mothers or whether they should be fighter pilots. The issue is that women should have the opportunity to decide for themselves and choose the path. And that's what we ought to support, the same as we support, equality based on race or religion or anything else. There was a comment made, by the way, earlier about Saudi Arabia. I agree completely. I have always said that what we should do with the Saudis is appoint a female ambassador, and the first thing she should do is get behind the wheel of her own car.
Absolutely.
And drive over to the ministry. She presents her credentials and basically say, deal with it.
Absolutely. Yep.
It's just the way the world is.
But in the diplomatic world, Sam, it's not going to happen. Ambassadors seldom drive themselves, but more importantly, you were taught to respect the customs and laws and traditions of the host countries. So but I don't think a U.S. ambassador
would
do so.
But why only in the diplomatic world? Why not on the – that is exact. Now you said it. See, you have to respect the customs and the laws. That is at the heart of the issue. That's it. That's all I've been saying. And I completely agree. Nobody should be forced to do anything. But that is at the heart of the issue here, that people are feeling they're being forced a different custom.
But again, I'm really sorry this penalizes all men. And the more we get into this, the deeper I wish we had.
Well, I watch View every morning. These are all women talking about.
I never watch The View, but I don't watch television.
I'm more than happy with that.
I don't watch television, but
we're going to try and stay neutral.
But in the struggles around the planet, women are on the forefront of the change in India, Pakistan, in the United States of America, in Ferguson, Missouri, in Nigeria,
in Egypt,
across the globe, and saying that no, there is a full seat at the table. This is not 1898. This is not 1814. It's not 1914. It's 2014, almost 2015, and we have a different world that is out there, and that's part of what we're. That's part of the pushback of some of the most fundamentalist groups around the globe, whether they be Jewish, or whether they be Muslim, or whether they be Christian, is the rising power of women, and that's part of the pushback we're seeing, I think.
Well, Mark, if you take the Arab world, for example, more than 50%, and in some countries even higher, is under 25. Large numbers of these people are women. More women are going to university than men in so many of these countries. They're being educated. They travel abroad. They have access to the internet and modern technology. They know what's going on in the rest of the world. They look at the same television programs. They look at the same movies. They listen to the same music. So it's a changed world in which you have greater interdependency and more interconnectedness between cultures and peoples. So my mom may have chosen to stay home and be a homemaker, but it's not the same for my sisters or my daughter. And you simply, as Sam said, it's not a question of forcing people to change their custom. It's giving people that choice. If you want to be a lawyer, or you want to be a doctor, or you want to be a teacher, or you want to stay home and raise your family, it's all appreciated.
So this has been an interesting twist in our conversation about international relations. I find it very interesting where we went with this, but I think it's important to have gone into that. And I'm curious, in the time we have left, to come back and talk a bit about, in the 10 minutes or so we have left, to talk about the United States and what our response needs to be to these issues we've been talking about around the globe, and how this country should proceed. I mean, that I think that, and where the rubber meets the road in all of this. Sam, you want to begin us off? Because it gets kind of, we all have very different ideas about this, I think.
So are we talking about these things writ large? You want to break them down individually, or how do you want to?
Well, we can talk about writ large, break it down individually. I mean, when the Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, stands up and goes, we are not standing down, we're going to face this. Or when we see what's going on in Nigeria, whether you disagree or disagree with him, Wole Soyinka, the great novelist and Nobel winner, said the United States needs to do more inside of Nigeria to help us defeat this Boko Haram, as you hear from Iraqis and Syrians saying the same thing. So what should be the U.S. response?
Well, so, I mean, I think, to go back to what I said earlier, that while we have some unifying themes here, that what you have to do is you have to approach on the ground the situation individually with an understanding of the particular factors, ethnic, tribal, religious, everything that are at play, and craft individual solutions. But here would be another thing I'd contribute to the debate. I think we have to accept the fact that the world is, there are a lot of problems in the world, and unfortunately, I am pessimistic about the near term, like out several decades. When you look at poverty, when you look at overpopulation, I don't see a decline in instability. I see a rise in instability in a lot of areas. And we simply can't afford the fantasy that we have the capacity to go around and fix every one of those problems. Like, we're going to go launch some program in every one of these countries and fix it. We're going to have, I mean, that's not an argument for total inaction or apathy. It's an argument for, let's be realistic. You can address situations in Nigeria, but some of the issues in Nigeria, you do not have the capacity to go fix Nigeria. The depth of the corruption, it's a country that by the end of the century may have a population of 1 billion.
That's right.
It has massive issues. We don't have, but maybe we have the capacity, but we're never going to do it. We're never going to go devote the resources to fix even that one country. So just accept that whatever you're going to do is going to be limited. You're going to work the issue around the margins.
And Max, just picking up where we left off, we have about 5 minutes left, but I think some of the things you look at in certain countries, how they were created, whether it's Pakistan or Nigeria, they're also dealing with the legacies of colonialism that created these countries, that is part of the root of the problem.
And that's for sure. Nigeria is probably about three or four countries put together as one, and these groups have never coexisted. They are forced to coexist now because the alternative is war and violence and instability. But more importantly, it's not solving the broader issue, which is corruption, poverty, underdevelopment, lack of opportunities. And I really believe these are not problems that can be solved in isolation. So although you need a homegrown indigenous solution to some of them, those ought to be decided multilaterally and not expect the United States, as Soyinka is calling for. Because if the United States were to get more involved in Nigeria, you could rest assured there will be a serious backlash against U.S., a greater U.S. presence in Nigeria. So I don't think the U.S. needs to be the leader, but I think bringing people together, taking it from a multilateral point of view, whether it's through the AU or through the United Nations or some other organization that is has not been created. But I think multilateral approach is the approach we are going to have to take. And we have to realize many of these problems are interconnected. So poverty is related to corruption. It's related to the unfair trading system or unfair economic system we have in the world. So we cannot address these issues in isolation.
You have the final word today, Fahim Yunus.
I agree with Sam's pessimism. The Ahmadiyya Muslim community has said it over and over again. Our worldwide Khalifa has traveled across the world, and he's clearly laid out that he's afraid of a third world war. He feels that the world is so turbulent today that one small misstep, one small miscalculation, and that's where we'll end up. What to do about it? Very clearly, we can not play the politics of oil anymore. We have to be very clear as to whether we are on the side of justice or whether we are on the side of our national interests. We need to spell out the criteria by which we really stand. Is it life, liberty, and justice for all? And if that's what it is, then it better get displayed in our actions.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. I really appreciate the three of you taking the time today. Even the diversion places we went to, which I think were important to have in this conversation. And Dr. Fahim Yunus has been with us here, senior fellow at the Hofburger Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore and a clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Maryland. Dr. Max Hilaire is with us, who is chairman of the Department of Political Science here at Morgan State University. Sam Faddis, retired CIA operations officer and author of numerous books. We'll be linking to his website. His latest novel is Kaffa. Fahim, Max, and Sam, thank the three of you so much for
thank
today.
Thank you,
Mac,
for inviting me.
On our way out of here, it's Earth, Wind, and Fire, and their song Gratitude. On this day in 1975, the band's album of the same name was certified gold. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Through good music, we're trying to say.